Welcome to another episode of RapCast, the official podcast of Rheumatology Advanced Practice Providers. I'm your host, Amanda Mixon, and I'm the current president of RAP. And today's episode, we are diving into a critical and complex topic that affects many of our patients, IL-17 inhibitors and their association with inflammatory bowel disease. Navigating the intricacies of IL-17 inhibitors can be challenging, especially when considering the potential risks and benefits for our patients with rheumatic disease. To help us understand this better, we have a distinguished guest with us today, Candace Ryan, an expert RAP faculty member. Candace brings a wealth of knowledge and experience in managing these therapies and understanding their impacts. Candace, welcome to RAPcast. We are thrilled to have you with us today to shed light on this important issue. For those of you that are unfamiliar, can you please give us a brief introduction?
Hi, Amanda, and thank you so much. It is a pleasure to be here with you guys today and to be able to discuss this critical topic with the community. My name is Candace Ryan. As Amanda said, I have been in rheumatology now for 16 years. I work in Phoenix, Arizona at Arizona Arthritis and Rheumatology Associates. We're a large practice. We have roughly 30 to 35 APPs, so we're really proud of that. And we have probably 20 to 25 physicians, so lots of APP usage and ability to help them provide high-quality care.
Fantastic. Well, like I said, welcome to the podcast. I think this episode is definitely needed. And, you know, of course, the goal really is to unravel these complexities surrounding IL-17 inhibitors, particularly in relation to IBD risk. Obviously, IL-17s have been a game changer really for us in the psoriasis world and the psoriatic arthritis world and, you know, spondylitis world. But I think it's important that we understand, you know, what the risks are. I kind of say that to all of my patients. I say it whenever I'm out lecturing, is that it's important to understand the benefits, but it's just as important to understand the risks. And so this discussion is really vital for clinicians who aim to provide the best care for their patients, also while navigating these potential complications. So with that, let's dive right in and explore current evidence, clinical experiences, and best practices for managing these therapies. So for our listeners who might not be familiar, can you provide some background on why there's this association between IL-17 inhibition and IBD, you know, as an important issue in rheumatology?
Yeah, absolutely. So as you know, the majority of our patients who come into the clinic with an inflammatory joint disease come in either one of two, I like to put them in one of two buckets. They either go into the rheumatoid arthritis bucket or the spondyloarthropathy bucket. And if they end up in the spondyloarthropathy bucket, this is basically an umbrella term or an encatchment for about 5 to 6 different disease states. So these are things like reactive arthritis, enteropathic arthritis. We also see our ankylosing spondylitis, our non-radiographic axSpA, and our psoriatic arthritis patients and go into there. And when these patients come in, they often come in with a plethora of different domains affecting their condition. So it's not just you have this is what it is, kind of like rheumatoid. There's a lot of things that kind of go into play or have to be considered when you're talking to a patient with a spondy. So you're looking for things like nail involvement. You're looking for psoriasis. You're looking for things like uveitis and inflammatory back disease. You're also looking for things like enthesitis and peripheral joint damage. And then, like we're going to talk about today, kind of the star of the show is you also have to be very concerned. Does the patient have history, and maybe even family history too, of an inflammatory bowel disease? If the patient comes in and they do have inflammatory bowel disease, it's important to get that information right up front. They don't always know. Sometimes they mistake it for IBD, or IBS. So you have to really delineate that between with the patients. And for the better part of my career, we have had nothing but TNFs, okay, to treat our spondy patients with. We would start them on a TNF. They would do to not so great. And then they would come back and we would change them to yet another TNF with not much unfortunate expectation that there was going to be a lot of change. Now, about in 2015, I believe, is when the first FDA approved IL-17 hit the market, which was Cosentyx. Cosentyx was basically a game changer for our space when it came to treating psoriatic arthritis, ankylosing spondylitis, and things like non-radiographic axSpA, because it allowed us to treat not only their skin components with great efficacy, but also to treat their peripheral arthritis components with great efficacy. I've had many conversations with patients in the past stating that if you really have the predominance of peripheral joint involvement, TNFs are really pretty good. They're not going to hit the high PASI 75s, 90s, and 100s that the IL-23s and the IL-17s can hit. However, they are really good with the joints. If you have a lot of skin involvement, then the IL-23s, they're super safe. They're super effective in the skin. However, if you do have that component of joint pain, they're not super great with that. Just this week, I've taken two patients off of an IL-23 agent and switched them to an IL-17 for that very complaint. They were like, my skin is zero psoriasis. I am completely clear and I am thrilled about that, but I am in pain and it is inhibiting my ability to do my job, to live my life, to have quality of life. So I need you to help me with that too. So this is when we've transitioned over to the IL-17s. And where our concern comes in our patients who do have a history of IBD. Because what happens is, let's just look in a little bit into the pathophysiology of why an IL-17 might cause an inflammatory bowel disease in the gut. So what we have in the gut, which is a barrier mucosal membrane organ, is you have IL-17 almost like helper cells. And what they do is they tend to repair damage done by either viruses or bacteria to the intestinal walls. So when you inhibit those cells from functioning, you have inhibition of repair. And that leads to things like microbacterial penetration and thus intestinal inflammation, which leads to our Crohn's diseases, ulcerative colitis. So I think that it's important for rheumatology to just be aware of the potential for an IBD flare and to educate the patients on signs and symptoms and the fact that it is a risk factor, because they all ask what, you know, we're happy to know what is it going to do for me, but we also want to know what's it going to do to me. So I think it's important that the rheumatology APP be very aware that there is a link between spondies and IBD, and the fact that there is a link between interleukin-17 inhibitors and sometimes flaring of IBD.
Absolutely. So, you know, there's a couple of things that you said that really, you know, stuck with me. I love talking to people that have been in rheumatology as long as I have, because, right, like, we've seen these things. Like, when I first started, you're right, we only had the TNFs. We didn't even have as many TNFs as we do now. And so you're absolutely right. We would literally just change them from one to another one to another one. And it was challenging because, as you know, as I know, you know, if they don't respond to two, they're not likely going to respond to a third one. And, you know, if, you know, unfortunately, maybe they didn't tolerate it or had some kind of contraindication, we were really stuck and we didn't have much else to offer these patients. And so, you know, it's lovely to see and be involved in this evolution of the biologics and now even the small molecules, to where we have so many medicines in our arsenal that we can use to treat these diseases. And I agree wholeheartedly. It was so exciting when the IL-17s hit the market, because they were game changers for us, because we didn't just have kind of, you know, one main class of drugs that we would use for patients. And now, you know, there are three IL-17s, and I mean, and all, you know, have their positives. And I totally agree. So I feel like, you know, and I would agree too with, you know, the IL-23 inhibition that you talked about. And I would say, you know, it's just knowing the right drug for the right patient. And it's lovely. They all have such good benefits. And of course, we have to just understand what the risks are. And I try to, you know, when I talk to, you know, people about it too, I'm kind of like, well, you do have to remember that the disease itself, potentially you might have an underlying IBD component to it. And you're right. We always have to kind of manage that. Like, is it IBS? Is it IBD? Who, you know, it can be challenging for patients too, because even when I ask them that question, when I'm doing my first history, do you have a history of IBD? And often then they say yes. And then it's actually, no, it's irritable bowel syndrome that they have, but they don't really kind of understand the differences. You know, that's why, again, it's so important that we know what drug is appropriate for what patient based on their domains, which really we're trying in our psoriatic arthritis patients and our spondy patients in general to have a domain-based approach so that we know if they have uveitis, we're going to choose this agent. If they have IBD, we're going to choose this agent, et cetera. So let's kind of transition a little bit to talking about some of the studies, because we obviously, when we're talking to our peers or to patients, we want to understand how we got to where we are. And so that obviously comes down to evidence-based medicine. So can you share some of the key studies or clinical trials that actually have investigated this link between IL-17 and IBD?
Sure. So what I did in preparation for this program is that I started looking at a meta-analysis, which I really enjoy meta-analysis because, number one, this was an independent meta-analysis. It had included phase 3 and phase 2 randomized control trials, and as well as long-term extension studies. It excluded post-hoc analyses and case reports, so I like that. It doesn't do a lot of repetitive data. And it was my favorite part of the entire study was that it was not pharma-sponsored, okay? So that's big for me when I'm looking at data. Its main purpose was to assess the overall risk of developing ILD or IBD due to IL-17 inhibition. And it was a compilation of 66 studies. These studies had over 19,000 patients in these studies, so it was a very large population size, which was nice. And they were looking for, basically, when a patient was on an IL-17, were they developing new IBD, or were they developing, or were they having flares of pre-existing IBD? And what they found was that in the induction cohort, about 12 patients of these 19,000+ had flares of their pre-existing IBD, and they found that 11 had new onset IBD type diseases. So basically the take home that I got from that was that IL-17s, they initially, like I said, found out a little earlier, they initially found out that IL-17s don't work to treat IBD when they were looking at a study to see if they could actually use it in IBD because it was working so well in the joints and so well in the skin. And they thought, well, what about the IBD sector of this? Could it work there too? And unfortunately, that's when they found out about the inhibition of those IL-17 helper cells. And so what we know from the study is that it's not necessarily that IBD is triggered by inhibition of IL-17. What we know is that people with rheumatologic conditions often have IBD in the background. So we can't use IL-17s to actually treat IBD because it can actually worsen the symptoms, but it makes the other symptoms so much better that it just makes the IBD seem that much more prevalent. And so that's why it's in such a forefront. I don't think it's necessarily that it's actually causing the IBD. It's just not showing as much improvement in the IBD as are some of the other agents.
Yeah, and that's kind of, you know, when I've talked with, you know, peers and patients and et cetera, you know, that's kind of been my take on it as well. And again, it's why it's so important to know your patients, which is going to kind of bring me to my next question. So thank you for doing all of that. I think that's so important. That's a lot of patients that have been studied. And ultimately, what I'm hearing you say, it's still a really low percentage. And so I think what we're showing is that, of course, these medications are very safe, you know, but you have to understand about this potential. So how, you know, as clinicians, right, like how can we mitigate that risk of IBD in our patients that we're considering prescribing an IL-17?
Absolutely. So first and foremost, have the conversation with the patient. You know, ask them, do you have a history of diarrhea? Okay, if you do, do you have abdominal pain to go along with it? Like I said, we have to sector out, is this IBS or IBD? If the patient says, yes, I have IBD, then obviously we're going to steer away from an IL-17. Fortunately, though, the GRAPPA guidelines gives us a ton of suggestions for other treatment modalities that we can use in our patients with an inflammatory spondy and an IBD, things like TNFs, things like IL-23s, and also now the JAK inhibitors. I will say that I tend to stay away from etanercept when I'm looking at my TNFs, when I'm picking for a patient with IBD. And if they say no, as far as I know, I don't have any history, and I don't even think I have a family history, then I start doing some preliminary labs. I start looking at things like CBCs and looking for signs of anemia, which they could be unaware of. I look at CMPs. I look for signs of hypokalemia, which could be as a result of chronic diarrhea. I look at B12 levels and I see if they're deficient in B12 because B12 is absorbed in the small intestine. And so if their small intestine is not functioning as it should, they could be B12 deficient. So all of these are just little pieces of the puzzle that we look at to try to get clues as to whether they may have an underlying IBD or not. I also look for increases in LFT elevations. This is a little bit tricky just simply because a lot of the medications that we use can also cause increases in LFT elevations. So it's a little hard to tease out if it's the IBD or the medications causing this. And then obviously they will typically have elevated acute phase reactants if they have an inflammatory bowel disease. But again, they could also have that as secondary to their inflammatory arthritis. Now, I did do some digging and found that there are a couple of biomarkers, if you will, that can kind of help us guess, maybe, if you will, if a patient is susceptible to the development of Crohn's or ulcerative colitis. Believe it or not, one of them is pretty familiar to us when we are looking at patients with vasculitis, the P-ANCA. Elevations in P-ANCA can lead to a higher suspicion that a patient may develop ulcerative colitis. And then the ASCA, the anti-Saccharomyces antibody, can also, if drawn and checked, show us a predisposition to Crohn's disease. Some studies in other countries, they're checking fecal calprotectin prior to starting their patients on an IL-17. I'm going to admit I don't do that. So I just want to be clear, but it is an option if you so choose. And then we would be remiss as clinicians if we didn't talk to our patients about lifestyle modifications during their visits, because there are things that people can do to help prevent flares of IBD along with while they're taking these medications that slightly raise their risk. So these are things like avoiding processed foods, foods with additives. I always tell my patients to follow more of an anti-inflammatory or Mediterranean diet. I really like it because it's full of fruits and vegetables. I think it's just good to be healthy in general. Always get enough sleep, try to reduce stress levels. And then the last but not least is I really strongly encourage any of my patients who are smokers to stop smoking.
Absolutely. I mean, I love all of that. And I, you know, obviously you really did your homework for this. I have to admit, I don't check, you know, that those labs either. I do sometimes, I see GI checking, not, you know, some of those things, you know, and for me, it's the same. I have that same conversation with patients and trying to tease, could they potentially, as part of their underlying spondyloarthropathy, have an inflammatory bowel disease? And certainly if at the beginning of that conversation, I'm suspicious that they could, I always want to get that checked out prior to initiating whatever drug we're going to do, because to your point, certainly the IL-17s are not going to treat that. And so you want to choose, that's kind of having that domain-based approach in treatment is saying, okay, if you have features of IBD, you're going to choose something different because you want to target that as well. And so again, I have that same discussion. And, you know, it's funny because 10 years ago, was I really talking to my patients a lot about lifestyle? I wasn't. I really wasn't. I mean, I really have changed. I really started to drink the Kool-Aid or not Kool-Aid because that's sugar. And I tell my patients not to have a lot of sugar, but the stuff we put in our body either helps us or hurts us. I believe that to my core. We know how we feel when we are eating healthy, more plant-based, more whole foods versus how we feel when we are eating a ton of preservatives, a ton of sugar, you know, et cetera. And so I can, of course, then talk to my patients about that. And that's exactly what I say, right? Like, you know how you feel when you ate the McDonald's versus how you feel when you ate a home-cooked, you know, good whole food meal. You know how you feel. Well, take it up a notch. You have an inflammatory disease. And so we really do have to focus on our diet. And of course, the smoking thing is a no-brainer. If someone needs, you know, but of course, you know, it's always, that's another piece to it. And so I totally agree. I say the exact same things to my patient. And I think that that's something that APPs do really well with. We do a really good job getting to know our patients and asking those important questions so that we can really pick the correct treatment modality for them. So what about monitoring your patients, right? Like, you've made a decision, the IL-17 inhibitor is the way you're going to go. Again, they have such good data for ACR scores and PASI scores and BASDI and all this stuff. So we've chosen this agent for our patient. What are you doing, or, you know, what would you might tell our listeners about monitoring, best practices for monitoring those patients? And, you know, what do you talk to them about, potential symptoms, et cetera?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's very important that you educate your patients. That is the first and foremost, is they need to know the signs of IBD. And this will hopefully help them not confuse it as much with IBS, but they could still. So we talk about the signs and symptoms. We educate them. Every single visit that they come in, when they're on an IL-17, they get a list of have you hads. It's have you had diarrhea, new onset? If so, has it been bloody or mucousy? Do you have abdominal pain that you didn't have before? Any trouble with fever on a daily basis, or chills, or nausea, or unexplained weight loss? Anything like that going on? And then, as any good clinician is doing, and I'm sure all of us are, physical exam, it's key. So get them up on the table, have them lay back, bend their knees, palpate their abdomen. You always want to focus on the left, upper, and lower quadrants, looking for any signs of tenderness. And if you have any suspicion they're presenting with any of these new symptoms, then obviously we hold the drug and then get them over to our GI colleagues as quickly as we can, who are probably going to update their colonoscopy if they've already had one, and then probably maybe do an abdominal CT scan.
Wow, you really are such a good clinician. And so I think, you know, what you're telling us is, which we all hopefully are doing, talk to your patients, ask them those questions. And to your point, a good physical exam will take you far. And I think often, you know, the longer that you're in this, I think sometimes we need those reminders of like, yeah, listen to their lungs, listen to their heart, and fill their belly, and listen to their belly. I mean, I think those things are important for us to remember, particularly, you know, if we have any concerns over, you know, some potential new onset of something. What about, so that's what you would tell, you know, obviously your peers, your other clinicians, but what about talking to patients? So what do you, I mean, you've already mentioned, you know, the stuff that you ask when when the patient comes in, but do you talk to your patients about the benefits and risks of IL-17 inhibition, and particularly concerning IBD? Like, what conversation are you having? So let's say it's a patient that has no risk, like they don't have a history of IBD, they're not complaining of anything. What do you say to those patients?
Okay, so when I see these patients, I'm totally pumped. Because first I try to find out if they're bio-naive or they're not, okay? Regardless of whether they are, I always encourage starting with a trial of an IL-17, because I have found, like we talked about a little bit earlier, that the TNFs are really great on the joints, okay? They work super good. Their ACR 20, 50, 70 scores are really great. Their skin, however, is not, you're not going to reach those really high passives marks that we're shooting for, because patients really do want to feel better and look better. I mean, psoriasis is a very devastating piece of this puzzle for these patients. It is mentally depressing for them. They're embarrassed to go out. They're embarrassed to be around family. They have to, in Phoenix, they have to wear long sleeves, long pants in 120 degree weather, which is zero on the fun scale. So I talk to them and I let them know it's not that you have to pick anymore. It's not that you have to decide what's more important to you. Is it looking good or feeling good? Because we can only do one. The IL-23s, they're super safe. I love their safety profile. And they're really, really good on the skin. Like I said, I had two patients this week with zero psoriasis. They were completely clear and stoked. However, their joints were bothering them, so we had to transition over to an IL-17. So my theory is, if we're going to end up there, why not start there? I mean, because we can have our patients, it is June 14th, it is not out of the realm of possibilities to have these people clear and feeling good, ready to party July 4th, okay? If we start them on an IL 17 within the next week or so. So yeah, I always talk to them and try to tell them that there is light at the end of the tunnel. There is hope. We do have great medications. And I always thank our patients, especially those who are participating in research trials, because medicine doesn't advance without research. So I tell them, you know, be thankful for people who have participated in trials and gotten these drugs approved by the FDA, because they are why you have them. And then we shift gears a little bit, because like I said, patients are like, okay, Candace, that is super great. I'm stoked. I have hope again. I'm feeling better already. But what's it going to do to me? Okay. Because that's their very next question. If you get that far, usually that sometimes comes before the, how is it going to help me? What's it going to do to me? Cause I see the TV commercials. I see all these side effects and to be frank, it's scared. They scare me. And so I tell them there's always potential for it to exacerbate an unknown. Like you said, this patient has no known history, no reason to suspect IBD, but I tell them, you know, we don't always know what's going on inside the tissue until there's a trigger event, and then it triggers it to become active. I explain to my patients all the time that likely it's genetic that you have, because I get the question, well, how did I get an autoimmune disease? Is it something I did? Did it something I ate or didn't eat? And I said, no, unfortunately, a lot of times it's just bad luck. It's something that you're genetically born with. And when it decides to rear its ugly head and wake up and become active and problematic in your life is anyone's guess. So I tell them, this could be a trigger event for us, you know, putting you on an IL-17. With benefit, there's always risk. However, I do feel like because of the studies that we have and the data that we know, the benefit far outweighs the risk. However, again, we go over those symptoms. Should you develop any symptoms, I have to know, okay? You can't, and I've had people tell me, you know, I'm having not an abdominal symptom, but I'm having an injection site reaction, but my psoriasis is so clear and my joints feel so good, I'm willing to put up with it. And I tell them, do not put up with the bowel or the abdominal symptoms, because this could be part of a bigger picture and leading to something that could be much worse than an injection site reaction.
Yeah, I love that. And I think, you know, basically we're just educating our patients, right? We're making sure that they are informed. I think the thing that I find is they really are looking to us to make that decision. I mean, I practice as a team, right? And I tell my patients that you have to feel good about what we're doing and I have to feel good about what we're doing. We both have to feel that way when we make a treatment decision. But what I often find is I certainly don't find this as being a deterrent for people to starting on an IL-17 inhibitor. If I am confident, if I know what I'm saying and how I'm saying it to the patients, and I do the very same. I just, you know, I make it very simple. Listen, if you start pooping blood, that is a problem and we need to look in to see what's going on. I mean, I keep it very simple for patients and because that's how I think about it. And, you know, and I kind of say the same thing, you know, this is an overlap type of disease. And so perhaps there was some underlying microscopic something that we brought out. And however, they're still really good drugs. They are, you know, very safe and the risk is low. And I, you know, and I think that's it, you know, and again, these patients are struggling so much. To your point, it's like, I don't know how you live in a place that goes to 120, but that's a different conversation for another day. But to be fully clothed in long sleeves in the middle of August because you're embarrassed, that's no way to live. And that's, you know, that's kind of what I say to people is, you know, there are benefits and risks with every single medication, but the benefits far outweigh what the risks are in terms of your quality of life and longevity of your life, because we're treating the underlying inflammatory disease.
Exactly.
Well, thank you so much. This was so helpful. Hopefully our listeners found this to be, you know, helpful and understanding. I love that you talked about the clinical trials so that we kind of really can see that the risk is low. It's not nothing. And so we should be understanding of that. But again, very low risk and just knowing our patients, talking to our patients. With that wraps up our episode for today. Thank you so much, Candace, for sharing your insights and expertise on IL-17 inhibition and the associated risks of IBD. obviously, this contribution will certainly provide us with a clear understanding of this complex issue.
Thank you so much, Amanda. It's been a pleasure to be here as an avid listener of the RAP cast. And it was fun to discuss this important topic.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I hope that this episode has been informative and helpful to all of our listeners. Please subscribe to RAPcast on your favorite podcast platform so that you can stay updated with our latest episode. Don't forget to explore our RAPcast ecosystem further. We are all over social media, so you can go to the website, rap.org. You can connect with us on Twitter at RoomAPP and Instagram at RoomAPP. We also have an app. Lots of exciting things coming in the RAP ecosystem that will be coming, as well as just more informational podcasts, not just on aisle 17 or aisle 23, but lots to come, because I think knowledge is power, and the more we know, the better that we do for our patients. So again, thanks so much for joining us today. And until next time, I'm Amanda Mixon, and reminding you to stay informed, stay engaged, and keep advancing your practice.